When we are considering both temporary and ultimate happiness, we are not going to accomplish either by pursuing the things of this life. We only achieve either temporary or ultimate happiness through the creation of positive karma, through the creation of virtue. There is no other way to get any kind of temporary pleasure or enjoyment or wealth. And there is no other way to create the causes for ultimate happiness, liberation itself. So whatever you need, temporary happiness, ultimate happiness, short-term happiness, long-term happiness, you're not going to get it by manipulating your external circumstances or doing something in the world to bring yourself that. According to the teachings of the Buddha, what creates our happiness, short or long-term, is what we create in our minds. The creation of positive or negative karma, that is what's going to make our experiences of happiness or suffering. It is based on the inner. It is based on the mind. That is how our happiness will come about, whether we're talking about temporary happiness in this world or the ultimate happiness of transcending this world. The Buddha Shakyamuni taught it is only through understanding the law of karma and practicing or living in accordance with that law, which are the teachings of Dharma, that's the only way we are going to create the causes for temporary or ultimate happiness, short or long-term happiness. As much as we try to manipulate external circumstances, as much as we try to acquire or manage substantial things, trying to get what we want, that is not the way to go about getting what we want. As much energy as we put into trying to make external phenomena behave and bring us happiness, we are never going to be able to make them bring us happiness. That those, all of those efforts regarding external phenomena and trying to manipulate them into causing our happiness, nothing meaningful will ever come of that. Mostly, all we will ever get is suffering. If we really want to bring about happiness, short or long term, we need to practice the Dharma. When we are considering the four thoughts that turn the mind, we can consider how difficult it is to get this human birth, and how this human birth is not going to last long. The truth of impermanence tells us we will very soon find ourselves in the bardo or in the next life. And we, all of us, don't want to go into the bardo or the next life empty-handed. So then we come to the third of the four thoughts that turn the mind. And the third is the contemplation on the truth of the law of karma, the law of cause and results. This is the real Dharma. This is the real pith of Dharma practice. It is understanding the law of cause and result. What is virtue and non-virtue? What makes good karma versus bad karma? This is what will enable us to have a little something in our hands, to have a little something in our purse when we enter the bardo. We have this human birth. We have this human body. But if we don't understand the law of karma, we will not use it in the most meaningful possible way, because we won't really know what to do with it and what not to do with it, what to use it for or what not to use it for. We have to understand karma. We have to understand there is good karma and bad karma. How do we create each? What are the results of each? This is what we have to know. Otherwise, we will create every kind of karma. If we don't know which is the good karma and which is the bad karma, we will just go ahead and create every different kind of karma based on all of our conflicting impulses as they arise. If we don't know the good from the bad, sometimes we'll create good, sometimes we'll create bad. We won't know the difference. But if we know which is good karma and which is bad karma, then we will be careful to create good karma. And that will set us on the path to becoming more and more effective. If we understand the teachings on the law of karma, we will know what is good karma and what is bad karma, and we will know that we want to be very careful to only create good karma, because karma doesn't just go away. Karma has its effect. The law of karma is the law of cause and result. The result of our karma is absolute, is inexorable. Karma doesn't just dissipate. Once something is bound up as good or bad karmic energy, that karmic energy doesn't just dissipate. It doesn't just go away. It doesn't just leak away if you leave it there long enough. That karmic energy exists, continues, endures until the circumstances are right for it to ripen. Since karmic energy doesn't just dissipate, we want to make sure that all the karma that we're creating is good karma. As we want to have good experiences, that happiness, temporary and ultimate, we want to make sure that we are always creating good karma. And that means we have to know the difference between what we should and shouldn't do in order to create good karma, what we should accept and what we should reject, what we should embrace or adopt, and what we should eliminate in our own behavior. That's the only way we will be able to tell which things we should do to put a little money in our purse to take with us. Otherwise, we won't know. We won't know how to pack for the journey of going to the bardo. We need to understand this, the truth of the law of karma, the truth of the law of causes and the connection to their effects. This life, this human life that we have, in order for it to be meaningful, we need to use it in the most effective possible way. And in order to know what is going to be the most effective way to use this human life, we need to understand the law of karma to know what to do and what not to do. Otherwise, we will not know how to use the opportunity presented by this precious human birth, even knowing that it will quickly be taken from us by the truth, knowing this by the truth of impermanence. As mentioned before, if you have a job, then you are always engaging with other people, and you are always making connections with others. And you are making connection with them, they are making connection with you, you are relying on them, they are relying on you. If we understand the truth of karma, then we will always want to try to have the best possible motivation in making all of those connections with others. Because this is how all of those connections can become virtue. By always trying to have the correct motivation, which is the very foundation or basis for any action being virtuous rather than non-virtuous, we will be able to slowly bring all of our actions onto the path of virtue. All of our actions will become virtuous if we approach them with a virtuous motivation. But if we don't believe the law of karma, if we don't believe that virtue only comes about through having positive motivation, and if we don't believe that it is only through virtue that we will be able to produce the result of happiness that we desire, we have no reason to modify our motivation. We have no reason to try to train our minds to have correct motivation. If we do believe in the law of karma, then suddenly we have a reason to try to have good motivation, because we understand that is the basis for virtue. That is the basis for the creation of good karma, which is what brings us temporary and ultimate happiness. Now we have a reason to establish good and pure motivation. As we work to establish pure motivation, we will bring benefit to ourselves and to others. This will bring benefit to us both in this life and in future lives. But without any understanding of or trust in the law of cause and result, then there's no reason even to talk about good motivation, positive karma, virtue, non-virtue. It becomes meaningless. If we understand and trust the teachings on the law of cause and result, then suddenly our motivation is of paramount importance. And we will want to conduct ourselves in our business dealings and in all of our connections with others in a positive way, with a good motivation and keeping our conduct and our activity virtuous. This means all of our business dealings and business relationships, we will want all of those connections to be positive, with good motivation and conducted according to virtue rather than non-virtue. Any kind of work that you are engaged in, you can use it as the foundation for creating virtue. It all depends on your motivation. Let's say you work in a hospital. Let's say you're a nurse. And let's say you always try to have good motivation and work motivated by altruism. Yes, it is your job, but your primary focus is not, oh, this is benefiting me and I'm getting paid because this is my work. You really try to make your primary motivation be, I am here to help these other beings. Nobody wants to be in the hospital. You don't go to a hospital because you're going to have a good time. You don't go to a hospital and be happy. People go to hospitals and they suffer. People go to hospitals because they're sick, because they're very elderly, because they've been injured or wounded. Basically, everyone in a hospital is in some kind of terrible situation and some kind of terrible suffering. If you're working as a nurse and really trying to cultivate the mind of altruism, the attitude of altruism, and always act from that attitude, you are surrounded by beings who are suffering. And you can think, I come to work for their benefit. I serve them for their benefit. This is an excellent way to have your work and have your motivation be in line with the law of cause and result. It doesn't just have to be, however, if you're in a position such as nursing where you are obviously and directly being of benefit to others. Really, any work that you do can be similarly motivated by a sense of altruism. Any connections that you're making with others can come from a similarly pure motivation. So you can always use whatever work you're doing, whatever activity you're engaged in, you can use it as part of your training in conducting yourself in accord with the law of karma. As long as you understand that we will only bring about happiness and positive results by creating positive causes, and that the essence of creating a positive cause is to have a good motivation or an altruistic mindset, then you will always be trying to do everything in the most virtuous possible way, meaning you will always be trying to be motivated by altruism. And if you understand that through selfishness and self-interest, by letting yourself fall under the power of the five poisons, you will only be creating non-virtue and negativity, which will only bring about suffering, both in this life and in future lives. With that understanding, you will always try to be avoiding those tendencies to non-virtue that you see popping up in your own mind. By having this respect for the law of karma, or by having this trust in the truth of the law of karma, you will naturally steer your own conduct more and more toward the good. You will strengthen your own habit of creating positive karma and of engaging in virtue. But we have to really understand that this is how things work. They don't work in some other way. And the law of karma is absolute. Whatever you sow, you have to reap. If you plant a poisonous seed, you're not going to be able to harvest a medicinal fruit from the plant that grows from that poisonous seed. But if you plant a medicinal seed, you are not going to be able to harvest a poisonous fruit from the plant that grows from that medicinal seed either. Causes bring about their results. It is inexorable. It is inevitable. We have to know the difference between virtue and non-virtue. We have to know that whatever we create, virtuous or non-virtuous, it will ripen into its result, good or bad. The way that karma ripens in various ways. There is the direct full ripening of a particular action, positive or negative. For example, if you kill someone and it is an act of hatred, a very weighty act of non-virtue, then the fully mature effect of that will be, for example, to be born in the hell realms. However, there isn't just that fully ripened effect. There is a cascade of other effects and factors that are set in motion by that powerful negativity as well. So, for example, You will be born, if you are born in a place that is very dangerous and that is very unpleasant and frightening, and you are always afraid for your life, then that will be the peripheral power of that same karma ripening. So it is not the fully ripened effect, the main effect of the karma, but that action also set in motion this tendency to be born in an environment that is terrifying and dangerous. And there will be other effects as well. One will still have the tendency, having killed once, one will continue to have the tendency to kill, and so forth. So each non-virtue that we create, it is the basis or the foundation, and then results spring from that. If we really understand that only negative results will come from non-virtue, only negative results will come about when we are acting under the power of our five poisons, there is no way that we will let ourselves continue to act under power of our five poisons, because it's really not worth it. But this is only the case, our minds will only turn completely away from non-virtue like that, if we really trust and really believe in the law of karma. And we only can really believe in the law of karma if we really understand it. And there are many teachings, teachings on what we should and shouldn't do, teachings on what kind of activities we should accept and reject. We can receive teachings that explain the mechanism of karma, the way that results unfold from their causes, and so forth. And having this understanding, this deeper understanding of karma, is very important, because it is through that understanding of karma, or based on that understanding of karma, that we will know how to practice and what to practice in order to make the best possible use of this human life, in order to make the best possible use of our opportunity to practice. So recognizing the truth of the law of karma and really internalizing the implications of that, that is a vital part of practice. Padmasambhava said himself, his view is as high as the sky, but his actions with respect to karma are so fine, they are refined like flour. If this is how Padmasambhava approached view and conduct, we should certainly be just as, if not more, careful in our actions than he was. It is said that in one's view, one should be like a hero. One should be brave and courageous. In one's actions, one should be like a coward, meaning you should be so careful not to commit non-virtue. These are the teachings of the lamas of the past and the greatest of the great. If Guru Rinpoche gave the law of karma such careful consideration, such trust, such respect of the truth of the law of karma, we ourselves, of course, should treat it with equal consideration and equal care. So that is the third of the four thoughts that turn the mind, the contemplation on the truth of the law of cause and result. Then the fourth concerns the faults of samsara, the fact that the nature of all samsaric experience is suffering. By and large, in samsara, only suffering is experienced, not really any happiness. And what this suffering is and why it is called suffering, we need to understand clearly. When Buddha Shakyamuni completed his path and attained full enlightenment at Bodh Gaya, then he did not teach for 7 weeks, not until Indra and the other gods requested him, offering him this golden thousand-spoked wheel and requesting him again and again to teach the profound Dharma. Not until that circumstance was the Buddha willing to teach, because, and then Trungpa gave the quote, but essentially he said, what I have understood or realized is so profound that nobody will understand it, and therefore I'm not going to teach it. And then when he finally agreed to speak or to teach under these extraordinary circumstances, what was the very first thing that he taught? He taught the truth of suffering, that we need to understand that the nature of samsara is suffering. If we don't understand that samsara, top to bottom, is all suffering, we won't want to be freed from samsara. That suffering, that samsara's nature is suffering, is an absolutely vital point to understand if you want to practice Dharma. Because if you don't think that the nature of samsara is really suffering, then you won't give up samsara. And you won't have any reason to follow the law of karma in order to be able to give up samsara. Because you won't have any reason to give up samsara if you're not convinced that samsara is nothing but suffering. If you're not convinced that samsara is nothing but trouble, you're still going to want samsara. You're not going to have renounced samsara. You won't have turned your mind away from samsara. You won't sincerely desire liberation from samsara. So of course you're not going to be able to practice in a way that's going to free you from samsara. When we practice the Dharma, we practice the antidotes to the afflictions. We are not going to want to practice those antidotes to the afflictions as long as we fail to recognize that the afflictions are the very things that are keeping us in samsara's suffering. First, we must understand that the nature of samsara is suffering, just as this was the Buddha's first teaching when he first spoke. Now, in samsara, you might argue, there is some happiness. There are some things that are pleasant and some things that are good in samsara. And you might say, I'm not suffering. I have good food to eat. I have beautiful clothes to wear. I'm young. I'm healthy. I'm beautiful. I have a wonderful house. I have a really fancy car. Everything is great. You might think that constitutes happiness and therefore you are beyond suffering. Well, that might all be great. You're right. But it's all still temporary. And it all can change at any moment. How many stories have we heard of someone in just that circumstance? Young, rich, beautiful, everything going their way. And then the next day they're a beggar on the street. We have no way of knowing if that's going to be our fate the next day or not. How can we rely on that happiness when it could end tomorrow? Or how many people are wildly successful when they're young and seem to be on top of the world with everything that they could possibly desire? And then they start taking drugs and getting involved in this and that, and then they end up in prison, and then they end up killing themselves. There are so many stories just like that. What happened to that happiness, that moment of happiness? That so-called happiness was of no benefit. In fact, that so-called happiness maybe laid the groundwork for their subsequent terrible suffering. So if we really want to practice the Dharma, we have to recognize that even the seeming happiness that is found in samsara is not real happiness that we can rely upon. It is temporary. It is subject to change. It is not reliable. Other than the practice of Dharma, there is no way of creating the causes for real, lasting happiness. As long as we rely on anything in samsara, it will eventually prove out to be nothing but suffering, for the nature of all samsaric phenomena is suffering. That we certainly need to think carefully about and understand if we really want to practice sincerely. So these are the four thoughts that turn the mind to Dharma practice. And I know you have heard these teachings again and again, and in fact practiced and contemplated and internalized them again and again. And as I mentioned this morning, I'm really not claiming to have anything special to say or anything to say that you have not heard before. But sometimes it is useful for Dharma friends, Dharma companions, to remind each other of the truth of these fundamental teachings and to help each other recognize and appreciate them. And so my thought was to share this again, to give you this little reminder, and maybe that would be of some benefit. As the masters of the past have said, the contemplation of these is indispensable for practice. And so, based on that, we should contemplate these and bring them to mind again and again. When we're speaking of the law of cause and result, maybe some people don't like to be reminded of that teaching. Maybe some people don't like to be reminded of the inexorability of the law of cause and result. But there's no reason to get angry or upset about it. If you are speaking of the law of cause and result, and if we as Dharma friends are trying to remind each other of the truth of these fundamentals of the path, then all we can do is try to help each other, try to give each other those useful reminders. If we don't try, then we're not holding up our end. So at least we need to try. That's our job. That's our responsibility. It's on us, on each of us, to help remind each other. If someone else doesn't like what we're saying, well, that's not actually our own fault. Look at the Buddha, Buddha Shakyamuni himself. Shantideva, actually, Rinpoche gave the quote. Shantideva said, Buddha Shakyamuni himself couldn't please all sentient beings. How can someone low, such as myself being Shantideva, how could I possibly hope to please all beings? Everyone has their own preferences. Each person has their own perspective and their own phenomena. You can't please everybody. Not even Buddha Shakyamuni could please everybody. If we are speaking as well as we can, if we are speaking the truth plainly and clearly, and then if others like it, then that's all well and good. Then we have been skillful. If others don't like it, there's no reason to be angry or upset about it. It's not our fault if they don't like what we are saying, if we are repeating these words of truth. So whether you like my words or not, this is what I have to say, the reminder that I have to offer you. These four thoughts that turn the mind, actually, if we really internalize them, they are extraordinary, and their effect on our practice is extraordinary. They are called the outer or common preliminaries. The inner preliminaries are called the uncommon. They are uncommon in the sense that they are not found in the Hinayana. They are not found in those teachings. The inner preliminaries are the five practices. First, refuge, and then bodhicitta, vajrasattva, mandala offering, and guru yoga. And these five uncommon or inner preliminaries, the first of them is refuge. And refuge is called the cornerstone of all paths, is taking refuge in the three jewels. And second, generating bodhicitta is the root of the path of Mahayana. Third, the purification of non-conducive circumstances, negativity and obscurations is the meditation on vajrasattva. Fourth, the accumulation of merit in order to bring conducive circumstances is the offering of the mandala. And fifth, the method to generate wisdom in one's mind stream, wisdom that surpasses the ordinary mind. The method to generate surpassing wisdom in one's mind stream is the practice of guru yoga. So these are the five inner or uncommon preliminaries. The first of these five inner preliminaries is to take refuge in the three jewels. And this is the cornerstone for all paths of Buddha Dharma. So whatever path of Dharma you are practicing, whatever of the Buddha's teachings you are following, you must take refuge in the three jewels. That is the cornerstone of your practice, whatever your Buddhist practice is, whatever Dharma it is that you are applying to your mind. We take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. What does it mean to take refuge? What does refuge actually mean? Refuge means to look to something to protect you from suffering. When you look to some object, something, as your protection from suffering, as your safety, your place of safety, where you cannot be harmed, that is your refuge. That is what it means to go for refuge. When we go for refuge in the Dharma context, we go for refuge in what? In whom? In the three jewels. In general, we go for refuge from ordinary sufferings in something powerful enough to protect us from that suffering, or something powerful enough to save us from that danger, whatever it might be. In the case of Dharma, what we are hoping to be saved from, or hoping for protection from, or hoping to find refuge from, are all the sufferings of samsara in its entirety. And only the three jewels are suitable as our object of refuge in that context. Generally, we can speak of worldly gods And there are local protectors and deities of different kinds and worldly gods and wisdom beings or wisdom gods. And we can look at these different kinds of beings that are powerful and offer different levels of protection and consider, are any of these suitable as objects of refuge? Well, among all those that were just mentioned, the wisdom beings, wisdom deities, are beyond this world. As wisdom deities, wisdom means they have transcended this world. They are fully enlightened beings. And since they have transcended this world, they are no longer subject to the sufferings of this world themselves. And therefore, being beyond this world's sufferings, they can offer us protection from this world's sufferings. All other gods or beings with divine characteristics of different kinds, or local protectors, or spirits of different kinds, as long as those beings that we're talking about, no matter how powerful, as long as they are still within samsara, meaning they are still worldly, it means they themselves have not yet transcended all of samsara's sufferings. And therefore, we do not take ultimate refuge in them. They are not beyond samsara themselves. How are they going to protect us from samsara's sufferings? They are not even able to protect themselves from samsara's sufferings. That being said, it is appropriate to rely on them to help us temporarily dispel negativity and obstacles on the path and create conducive circumstances and bring auspiciousness. And therefore, we can offer them tormas and we can supplicate them and so on and so forth. It's perfectly appropriate to be in that kind of relationship with these worldly deities, worldly beings, worldly gods. But we don't look to them for ultimate refuge because they are still in the world. They are not beyond samsara's sufferings themselves. Therefore, they cannot protect us from samsara's sufferings. That is not within their power. The three jewels, on the other hand, are entirely beyond this world, meaning they are not subject to samsara's sufferings. They have transcended samsara completely. And therefore, they have the power to actually protect us from samsara's sufferings, to actually save us from all of samsara's danger and fears. That is their power, that is their blessing, that is their capacity or potential. That is why they are suitable to take as our objects of refuge when we are going for refuge from all of samsara's sufferings, which is what it means in this case as the first of the five inner ngundro practices. The second of the ngundro practices, the inner ngundro practices, is to cultivate bodhicitta, which is the root of the Mahayana path. And when we speak of cultivating bodhicitta, and you have all heard the teachings again and again, we speak of aspirational bodhicitta and engaged bodhicitta. We speak of relative and ultimate bodhicitta. We talk of the four immeasurables as the foundation for giving rise to bodhicitta. And all of these different teachings are going to help us actually bring our minds to the point where perfect bodhicitta can be cultivated. However, if we have not received all of these elaborate teachings on the different kinds of bodhicitta and the step-by-step way to give rise to it in its perfect form and so forth, if we haven't had the opportunity to hear these teachings, does that mean that we're hopeless and we can't cultivate bodhicitta at all? No. To cultivate bodhicitta, fundamentally, one should have this great wish, this great desire to be able to rescue all beings from the sufferings of samsara, protect them from samsara's sufferings, save them from samsara's sufferings, and help them to never need to suffer again. This essential wish to free other beings from suffering, this compassionate wish, this loving and kind wish, this is the most simple way to explain how to cultivate bodhicitta. And if you train your mind in giving rise to this intention, giving rise to this wish to bring benefit to others and to save them from their suffering, to be of benefit to them however you can, that is the very essence of bodhicitta. And cultivating bodhicitta is the root of the Mahayana path. And to train in cultivating bodhicitta is the second of the five inner preliminaries, or the five inner ngundro practices. And then, in order to purify obscurations and negativity, one performs the practice of purification, usually relying upon Vajrasattva as the deity. We encounter obstacles on the path because we ourselves have accumulated negativity. We have created negativity, our minds are obscured, and because of these negative circumstances that we ourselves have created, then things do not go smoothly for us. We don't easily meet with success. And instead, there are obstacles and difficulties of every kind. And so in order to clear away all obstacles and difficulties on the path, and so that we might be able to proceed smoothly on our path, we engage in this purification of negativity, usually relying on Vajrasattva. In order to purify our negativity, we first have to recognize that there is no good quality of negativity whatsoever. Well, actually, there's one, and that is that you can purify it through confession. But other than that, there is nothing good that can be said about negativity. There is nothing good that can be said about our own previously accumulated negative karma. When it ripens and arises for us, it arises as obstacles, as difficulties of every kind. And when we say obstacles, obstacles to what? Or what does that mean? Obstacles are whatever is interfering with our success. We can speak of obstacles to worldly ventures or obstacles on the path that are blocking our realization and enlightenment. But in essence, obstacles are what keeps us from moving smoothly toward success. And it is fundamentally our negativity that creates all obstacles. So that is what we need to purify. That being the one good quality of obstacles, that they can be purified. So in this section of the Ngunro, we purify our negativity in order to clear away obstacles, particularly the obstacles to our Dharma practice. And we can rely on any yidam, on any deity, in order to perform the purification or enact the purification, but particularly Vajrasattva, because Vajrasattva made aspirations that those who supplicate him and meditate upon him and recite his mantra will be able to purify their negativity swiftly, powerfully, and effectively. And they will no longer have obstacles to their Dharma practice or on their path to enlightenment. So we perform purification by meditating on Vajrasattva. And then, fourth is the offering of the mandala. And just as we meditate on Vajrasattva in order to purify negativity so that we might not have any difficulty on the path, we accumulate merit through the process of offering the mandala so that everything might go well and we might have all that we need on the path, so that all circumstances might be auspicious and conducive. So everything might go smoothly on our path to liberation and omniscience. In order for things to go smoothly, we need to have accumulated merit. There's many different ways you can accumulate merit. There's many different ways you can gather the two accumulations. There is the conceptual accumulation of merit and the non-conceptual accumulation of wisdom. There is accumulation by gathering actual physical offerings. There is the accumulation of merit through mentally emanated offerings. There are many things that can be said. But essentially, at this point in the practice, you accumulate great merit by the mandala offering, because the mandala offering is a method tremendously powerful, very potent, with great blessings. It is relatively concise and easy to recite, and produces this great abundance of merit all at once. You visualize Mount Meru surrounded by the four continents and so forth, and take this as the basis of your visualization. And through reciting the actual verses, then you offer. You offer all that you are visualizing. And through this, you swiftly accumulate great merit. And accumulating merit is really creating the causes for your own enlightenment. So that you might be able to actually attain enlightenment, you need tremendous merit. So you are accumulating merit that all might go smoothly, that all might be conducive, and you might have all the causes needed in order to actually attain full enlightenment. And the fifth and final stage of the inner preliminaries is Guru Yoga, the practice of uniting one's mind with the Guru. And this is the method that gives rise to wisdom realization. In order to achieve Buddhahood, we have to realize this wisdom that transcends the ordinary mind. And the way that we can realize this is by performing this practice of Guru Yoga. In the practice, you see the Lama as an actual Buddha, as a Buddha in the flesh. And you think that the Lama as the Buddha as the Buddha and Lama inseparable, that they grant their blessings, that their blessings fill your mind stream, and that your mind mingles to be inseparable with the Guru's mind, the Buddha's mind. And this is the method that's used in order, to generate wisdom or wisdom realization. These are the five inner sections of the Ngundro practice, and they are called uncommon or extraordinary, and because they are not found in the Hinayana teachings. And the Ngundro, we should know, is called the preliminary practice. But in actual meaning and in its pragmatic effect, when done correctly, it is no different from the actual practice that allegedly comes after it. There is no one on the path who doesn't need Ngundro. You never get beyond Ngundro. All the way up until Buddhahood, you still need to do your Ngundro. Really, only a fully enlightened Buddha has finally reached the point where they don't need Ngundro any longer. Because the essence of Ngundro is you are accumulating merit and purifying negativity, which you need to do all the way up until you attain ultimate realization, until you attain Buddhahood itself. How long do you need refuge? You need to take refuge all the way up until you become a Buddha. Refuge is in Ngundro. How long do you need to cultivate bodhicitta? You need to cultivate bodhicitta all the way up until you become a Buddha. Bodhicitta is in Ngundro. How long do you need to accumulate merit? You need to accumulate merit all the way up until you become a Buddha. Accumulation of merit as mandala offering, that's included in Ngundro. How long do you need to purify negativity? You need to purify negativity until you reach enlightenment as a perfect Buddha. The purification of negativity as the meditation on Vajrasattva, that's in Ngundro. Everything is in Ngundro, everything that you need on the path. And you need it all the way up until Buddhahood itself. So don't make the mistake of thinking that the Ngundro is just a preliminary that you finish and then you go on to the real thing. I see again and again that people accumulate their Ngundro or do their Ngundro, but that it doesn't really have a profound transformative effect on their mind. And unless you are really trying to internalize each section of the Ngundro, unless you're really taking each section to heart and really doing it sincerely with consideration of what each section means, unless you're really doing your Ngundro wholeheartedly, to merely perform the accumulations of the 500,000, to just recite in order to get the numbers, it wouldn't matter if you did 20 Ngundros or 100 Ngundros. They still wouldn't be of any real benefit to you. They still would not have a profound transformative effect on your mind. They still wouldn't bring vast accumulation of merit or purification of negativity, because you have to do the Ngundro with all your heart. You have to do the Ngundro very sincerely. You have to bring forth faith in the three jewels and cultivate compassion for sentient beings and see the Lama as the Buddha and then do the Ngundro. And if you're doing the Ngundro in that way, as a real mind training, as a way to put all the Dharma that you have heard into practice, then to train in the Ngundro is really going to be of benefit to you. This isn't just a problem with Westerners, This isn't just a problem with those who were not born in India or Tibet or whatever the case may be. Really, everyone, of course, naturally tends to make this mistake. You really have to do the Ngundro with all your heart. Because as with any dharma, it is going to transform your mind if you're doing it properly. Your mind will not be like it was before if you're really doing the practice wholeheartedly. If you look in your mind after practicing for some time, after doing your Ngundro, for example, and your poisons and passions are just as virulent as they were before, if your negativity is just as powerful, if your ignorance is just as intense as it was before, then that means you have not been really doing the practice properly. Because when you do the practice properly, it is an antidote to the five poisons. It is an antidote to your negativity, to your afflictions, to your passions, to your poisons. This is why we have to check for ourselves and see, is my mind improving with my practice? Or am I just like I was before? If you complete a Ngundro and you have no more faith, no more devotion than you did before, if your mind is just as filled with negativity and you are still just as much at the mercy of your five poisons as when you started, then it means you're not doing it right. There's something wrong. It means that you still need to do the Ngundro again, because it is through the Ngundro that we will accumulate merit and purify negativity and actually be able to rid our minds of the five poisons and rid our minds of the afflictions. And frankly, that's the whole process of the path until you reach Buddhahood itself. Each one of us needs to consider very carefully what is going to be of the most possible benefit to us. The benefit on the greatest scale, with the greatest scope, in the longest term, according to the largest perspective. What do I want to put my energy into? What's going to be most meaningful? What's going to bring the most meaningful result for me? Think carefully about that. How do we bring about our own greatest possible benefit? We have to practice. And when we practice, we don't practice in isolation. We practice by relying on others. Without relying on others, we can't practice. We can't practice the six perfections. We can't train in bodhicitta. We can't perform the practices that bring liberation even in one life and one body without relying on others. We can't practice only in isolation. We always practice relying on each other. And the greatest way to accomplish your own benefit is to work to bring benefit to others. For when you try to bring benefit to others, your own benefit naturally happens as a matter of course. This is certain. This is unquestionable. Recognizing the sufferings of samsara, you will realize that the greatest good you could do yourself is to free yourself from samsara in its entirety. And based on that, turning away from samsara sincerely with that thought, then you rely upon a lama, you follow the law of karma, and you work to bring benefit to others. It is only by relying on other sentient beings that we can really practice. It is the only way that we can practice the six perfections. You can't practice generosity unless you rely on others. Discipline, patience, mental concentration, enthusiastic perseverance. You develop all of these qualities by relying on others. If you recognize that it is only by relying on others that you will be able to do yourself any good, and that all these others that you are relying on are themselves suffering in samsara, while they are doing you this good as acting as the basis for your practice, they themselves continue to suffer in samsara, by and large without any notion of how to free themselves from that suffering, then you will very naturally feel this great sense of gratitude and compassion for them. And this will help the qualities come forth in your mind. Here I am, saying perhaps the same things again and again. My motivation is really just that I was hoping to bring some kind of benefit to whoever might come here today. I wanted to come and say a few words, and so I have spent the day talking to you. And really my hope is that There might be some benefit from this. Even if one word will be of benefit to you, then I pray that you will hold it in your mind and put it into practice. And I thank you for coming, perhaps wasting your time. If there is any benefit here, then I hope that you will hold whatever I might have said that would be of benefit. I hope that you keep that with you and put it into practice. If nothing I said was of any benefit, then just forget it. Aside from wasting your time, which I'm very sorry for, it's really nothing to me either way if I have managed to benefit you or not. It's neither benefits nor harm me either way. But if I have not said anything of benefit, then I am sorry for wasting your time. Principally, each of us must check our own minds. Each of us has to do the Dharma ourselves. No one else can do it for us. We ourselves know what our own motivation is. And it is based on our motivation and our understanding. That is what will make the Dharma that we do great or small. It is really dependent on our own outlook, our own attitude, our own intention, our own motivation. There's really nothing that another person can do. We have to do the practice ourselves. We have to do the work of looking within, looking at our own minds, looking at our own faults. I didn't come here to make some big deal or pretend to be some big deal. That was not my purpose. But I just wanted to share a few words of advice or experience or observation with you. Each of us has to do our own practice. It boils down to that. There is nothing that we can do except train our own minds, look within our own minds. No one else is going to be able to reach in and do that for us. It requires us to not only hear the teachings, but actively to take them up, to apply them to our own minds, to engage with them directly ourselves. There is a saying in Golok, which I'm going to translate probably very poorly, but the idea is that the wind will not fetch the grass and put it in the sleeping cow's mouth. Something kind of like that. If the cow has been eating and then lies down to sleep, the wind is not going to keep bringing the grass and putting the grass in the cow's mouth. If the cow wants to keep getting grass in its mouth, the cow has to keep going after the grass and eating the grass itself. In the same way, when we are thinking of the Dharma, it does us no good to rest on our laurels and think, I got plenty of Dharma. Now I'm just going to sleep. It's not like that. Each of us needs to apply the Dharma that we have received to our own minds. We have to keep reminding ourselves of the Dharma. We have to keep actively bringing the Dharma into our mind, mingling the meaning of the Dharma with our mind. That is what will make the Dharma more and more meaningful. That is what will make all that we do with our life meaningful, transforming all that we do into the Dharma. So please consider this carefully, and thank you.
Sorry, not finished yet. Very short.
It's just short, I promise.
Lama sugu chu sona, lama si chu shadna. Then you all ngala shakiore, ngala lakiore, some sozo semla correct, pekashibore. Oh, not in a marriage, jamba jila jilavore, jamba jila lavore, some semla pantokomare. This is your Samian tambod. Then you niba da dana ni yamter, parmo yangarja de jiata, chibayan, tamajang, sarba manduka, shirtanga munenga to shirsonjig, tambare, semjing, defkidje. Then it turns and kiu tamchetama to Nyoma Pala Chonsona, Dava, Chini Mangor Nima to Jabje Rimboche, Ni Jankam La Pepson. Then I did Nyoma Galama Mancheva Tata and Gonlo Diba Mambo Yore. Then I indeed Dakshaka, Geron to Metro Sala Lava, Pilar Kirtani, Jabje Rimboche Tataku, Sojang, Jenny Juliore. Ti kuse Japetania Lata, Tanan Lavatama, Mixer Jama made a Sami Tungton, Chumson, Tamsik. Yahoo Toyatan, Sosola, Parolan, Chambo Sheya. Then you are on Suda Tsukpak gareze board member la. So su tsukpak board member mumbak. Kocho la kukur tang. Kocho gare lamna taso tsunjok tang yakbo sheche. Teni board member mirna tsu yung. Ma jamba board member mayim bimba taso yung. Chik nipchu nanda tenda chik kanko ngala gancha yosamne gancha la pecho tang nindra manda. Si nyanga marang wane li jimdi yuk se li jimdi zari yora. Nija parsir niwa ke li jimdi goni. Oh, ta ma chik pe lagang sangma she gandu lika li gandu takpar kola lika li ka chukni. Jamba tozo li gandu mundu lapok mundu tukba zaong samni. Tena chapar shina tani yagba mari. Sama chapar ma shani nyam lika yakho li ji. Tani lo chung chung tisu lo yara gango tisu yara chik. Tini lirne chikta yara chik manga yo pata su manga me pata songone chik pe li jimdi goni pe tangarnyum goni pa yakbo she chitang. Tini chik lirne wa mayim bita su lirne pata su kare labna tela chik yang chik tsupkur tang tenda she ni pe yakbo she chit ke chapo re ta to songi riba yang pkir ju yin ta. Ta nang gmad nang bzin dama jang topa mandu ta nang gjuba nang bzin dama ke chokandu. Any two J che number one and then the cavalry consortium ni pebre, the ni certain ODD la two J che, chapter to ni sashi kajurla two J che, number soma two J che, the Muslim de Mamba lawyer may got in che. Done.
Two things. The first is whenever a Lama teaches the Dharma, whenever a Lama is giving advice, you should always think that their finger is pointing at you. You should always think that they're talking to you. This is a very important point. If you don't think that they're talking about you, then their words are not going to be of any benefit to you. If you think, oh, they're just talking about everyone else, they're not talking about me, then their words are not going to be of any benefit to you, of any use to you. So this is a very important point. That was the first thing. And second, again, I join my hands. I join my palms at my heart. It seems that there really isn't anyone new come here this afternoon that I would need to repeat what I said this morning. But along the lines of considering the enduring of the Buddha's doctrine in the world and the welfare and happiness of all sentient beings and the long life and flourishing of those who hold the doctrine or the lamas and teachers of the doctrine. In the last month, in the last few weeks, we have had two great lamas of the Nyingma tradition who have passed away. And our personal lama, Gyaltsa Rinpoche, is still with us, which is wonderful, surpassing all things. And may he live long, and may his lotus feet remain firm with us in this world. But in order to keep the great masters here, that they might have the conducive circumstances necessary for their long life and the flourishing of their activities, it is upon all of us, the responsibility is upon all of us to maintain harmony and pure discipline and to keep our samaya purely. And this means, as I mentioned this morning, to treat each other with affection, with love and respect, and particularly really to respect one another at the Dharma Center and in the Sangha. Whether you have some kind of official title within the community, whether you are a board member or not, each person in the Sangha should respect all the other people in the Sangha. And this is how the entire community will be able to flourish, will be able to support the guru's activities, and really on a deeper level will support the guru's longevity itself. There shouldn't be any kind of contempt or looking down on those who don't have some official position or some formal place. If you think, oh, I'm not on the board or anything important like that, I don't have any say in what's going on, and therefore it's all nothing to me. That's not the correct way to think of it. Each person who comes and participates here, we are all part of the Sangha. And we should, each of us, recognize that our relation to the Dharma Center is a way for us to accumulate merit and purify negativity. And we should hold in mind the teachings on the law of cause and result. If we really believe in the law of cause and result, if we really trust that is true, and that virtue brings happiness and non-virtue brings suffering, then we will see that it is upon each of us to create virtue in our relation to the Dharma Center. And in this, our relation to the Dharma Center is personal. It doesn't rely on anyone else. We relate to the Dharma Center as our opportunity to create merit and to purify negativity. And we don't need to be angry with others, to be upset with others. We don't need to engage in any kind of negativity in relation to the Dharma Center or our Dharma companions, the Sangha here. There should be respect between all of the members, respect for those who are not in positions of leadership, respect for those who are, respect by the leaders for those who are not in positions of leadership, but who come and participate. The young should respect the old and vice versa. There should be respect, fundamental human respect among all members. And as we are all followers of the same lamas, and we all wish for the long lives of our shared lamas, then we should know that our own part in assuring or making the conditions for the long life of the lama is to keep harmony with our Sangha brothers and sisters and to keep pure discipline. However we come and contribute at the Dharma Center, then that is our opportunity. That is based on our understanding of the law and of cause and result and our understanding of how to create virtue. And it is fulfilling the wishes of our gurus. For as part of keeping harmony and holding pure samaya, we should do those things that our lamas have told us to do. If we really want them to have long life, that has to be included. It's not okay to disobey the lama, to fail to do what the Lama has requested. If you want the Lama to have a long life, you need to keep harmony, you need to have pure samaya, you need to have pure discipline, and you need to actually do what the Lama has requested you to do. So, whether you have an official position or not, whether you have some kind of high-sounding name or not, really, the important thing for each person is that they are conducting themselves in accord with the law of cause and result. Each of us needs to consider this for ourselves. Yes, we need to treat each other with respect. Yes, we need to listen to what those in positions of leadership say as part of keeping harmony and as part of supporting the Dharma Center and helping it to flourish. But really, everyone needs to respect each other, and everyone needs to base their conduct on an understanding of the law of cause and result. This is how we will keep harmony, pure discipline, and samaya, and this will be the greatest possible support for the longevity of our gurus. Thank you all for coming. Many of you have come long distances. Thank you for taking the time and going to the trouble. And in general, I thank Orgyen Dorje Den for providing me with this opportunity. I thank the translator and everyone who contributed.